Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians. We're in the middle of chapter 8, talking about when the exercise of rights, by this we mean Christian rights, is wrong. The epistle to the Corinthians is built around issues that had been brought to the apostles' attention by representatives of that particular body. As we transition from topic to topic in this epistle, the normal indication of a new subject matter is now concerning things, and then we learn what those things are. Well, in this case, he opens a new discussion, and he says, now concerning things sacrificed to idols. Stop right there and let us establish again the historical context before we move down to verse 7. Since some of you are not able to listen every day, we need to kind of catch up with ourselves a bit. The ancient world was full of open, manifest material idolatry. It was very loud, one might say, very bold. Idols were everywhere and majestic in terms of human art. Pagan temples were all over the landscape. They were kind of the centerpiece of the social life of the pagan world. When people were converted from pagan religions and came to know Christ, to know the true and living God, it didn't change the social structure, and those who wanted to be integrated with that culture faced some difficult choices. They would be invited to festivities, and there were a lot of them, by still friends and neighbors to go to these pagan places and there to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Now, there was also another way that that occurred when these meats that had been sacrificed to idols were not totally consumed. Then they were taken and auctioned off at the public marketplace, and Christian people would go there, just like you'd go to your local supermarket and buy meat. But for them, there was an issue, at least for some. Mr. Butcher, has this meat come from an idol's temple? Is this part of the auctioned off meat? I don't want to eat anything, some of them would say, that had been offered to an idol. There were other believers who had a different perspective. They had a proper knowledge and a proper understanding. They knew good and well, and Paul talks about this, that there were no such things as idols. I mean, the deity supposedly represented by these material idols had no real existence, and they knew that, and so there was no danger in their own minds of them being seduced into worshiping an idol. By sitting down at a table and eating meat that had been offered to idols, they could smirk at the whole thing, knowing that this was meaningless. It's kind of like an atheist might come to a church service, dissing the whole idea of God, but be there for the baptism of a child, a grandchild, or something like that, and smirk his way through the whole ceremony. That kind of thing happens all the time. Well, so Christians, who in their case knew good and well these idols had no real existence, smug in their knowledge of that, would go to an idol's temple. But the risk was that when they went, they might somehow influence other Christians whose consciences were not so pure in that knowledge and induce them to eat against their conscience. Now, that's kind of where we are in this text. Well, the point that the apostle has made in the first 7 verses, I mean, the larger point is this. Look, I know some of you have good theological knowledge and understanding about this. You can negotiate your way around to idols without in any way getting your conscience in disrepair. You understand that idols don't exist, and when you partake of those meats or you buy them in the marketplace, it's not a big deal to you because those things are a figment of men's imaginations. But let me tell you something, he says. Knowledge alone tends to just puff people up, make them arrogant, and make them foolish. That's the irony of it when they get into arrogance, because anybody who thinks he knows everything knows nothing as he ought to know. What's important is to operate in our relationships with society and our Christian brothers, to operate according to the rule of love. When anybody does that, when anybody is looking out for the good of Christ and for the good of others, then that person has favor with God. Now, we come down to verse 7, where he gets specifically into the issue that I mentioned at the head of this study, when the exercise of rights is wrong. In verses 7 and 8, he says, however, not all men have this knowledge. When he says knowledge, he's talking about theological knowledge, knowledge and understanding of higher reality. Not all men have this knowledge, have this understanding. But here's the problem that you face, those of you who have this knowledge, and here's where love has to enter the picture. He said some, he means some believers, being accustomed to the idol right up until this very minute, they eat that food, if they did eat it, they eat meat offered to idols as if it were sacrificed to an idol, that is, to something real, and if they partake of it, then they feel like they've compromised themselves religiously, that they have been disloyal to God, and their conscience being weak, in other words, their conscience cannot get accommodated to eating meat that has been offered to an idol, because that, as I say, makes them feel like they have divided their allegiance to God. Their conscience is injured. It is defiled. Now, he says in verse 8, let me tell you something. Food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat. We're not better if we do eat. Here's what you've got to watch out for, but take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. It's like the mission field, folks, where new converts find it difficult to shake off a belief in witchcraft and magic powers and counterfeit spirits. When they're not able to shed the feeling that the idol was somehow a real entity, when these folk ate meat that had been dedicated to an idol that they were accustomed to thinking of as real, and they just can't quite get that out of their mind, their conscience is wounded. They feel they were somehow disloyal and they have sinned. A guy approaches a woman with a wandering eye. It does not matter if the woman who attracted him turns out to be a wax figure. Infidelity was there in spirit, you see. He thought she was real, and he was therefore disloyal to his wife, even though it turned out the woman that he lusted after was, upon closer inspection, merely a wax figure. I think you can see that analogy here. Well, Paul points out, you've got to understand, those of you who have good knowledge, and understand that these idols are just physical images that really stand for nothing. Some Christian consciences, if we're going to walk in love, we must understand they are weak. Now, what is a weak conscience? A weak conscience is one that is mistrained and misinformed by cultural conditioning, or mistrained and misinformed by previous religious training, and therefore, because of that mistraining, because of that misinformation, has learned to regard things as wrong in the sight of God, which really are not wrong. They are matters indifferent in the sight of God. For example, growing up back in my native state of West Virginia, I was exposed to some pretty raw legalism in the vein of don't dance, don't smoke, don't cuss, don't chew, and don't go with girls that do. Now, that's not to go out and say that those are recommended habits. All I'm saying is these are not things that God necessarily condemns in the Scriptures. It's kind of like my dad one time told a pastor who came from a notoriously legalistic college. Dad was at that time chairman of the deacon board, and after the service, he kind of drew the pastor off into the cloakroom, and after hearing 10 weeks of this, he finally told him, Pastor, you've taken 10 weeks to tell us about the sins that you think are wrong. I suggest that now you take 10 weeks to tell us about the sins that God says are wrong. Well, Dad was putting his finger on legalism. Well, there are consciences that have been trained legalistically, trained to believe that certain things are wrong. Some people are trained to believe that having a Christmas tree is wrong. They've been trained all their lives to think that way, and if they think that having a Christmas tree is wrong, it's hard for them to get it out of their minds. If you bring a Christmas tree into their house, that they're not doing something wrong. That's a weak conscience. I've said in my programs again and again and again, I do not have any part of social drinking. I don't believe the Bible, however, teaches us that social drinking is in itself wrong. Excess in eating or drinking is gluttony, and it is wrong. But if you've been trained to believe that alcohol is wrong, period, then it's hard for the conscience to get unwound and to come to understand that this is a matter of indifference to God. And so if you were to take a drink, certainly my wife would be in that category. Her father might be described as an alcoholic, certainly a binge drinker, and she hates alcohol. And it would be very hard for her, it'd be impossible, I think, for her to ever take a social drink without it violating her conscience. Well, that is called a weak conscience. That is not a weak person, but that is a weak conscience because the conscience has been mistrained. It's been misinformed in certain directions. And because of that, this person's conscience is very susceptible to wounding by the violation of things that are morally indifferent in the sight of God. Now, if those of us who have a strong, healthy conscience in those matters, in our knowledge, we poo-poo these people, we deride them, we mock them, and say, oh, get over that. That is so dumb. How could you think of anything like that and just insist on either pushing it down their throats or try to do everything we can to pull on them to get over it? They can't get over it, but they want to be socially accepted like everybody else, and so they eventually give in, and they go eat, I use it now as a figure, idol's meat against their conscience. Then their conscience is wounded, and they're spiritually injured, and we have not walked in love. So a weak conscience is one that views things that are actually indifferent to God as practices that are matters of consequence to Him. And if we do these things or we keep these observances, whatever they are, then a person who has this legalistic streak thinks they render us more acceptable to God, or if we do not do them and do not observe us, they make us more acceptable or presentable to Him. In reality, if we really understood what God had revealed to us, if we grasp maturely the principles of divine revelation and divine grace, we would know that in and of themselves, certain of these matters are matters of indifference to God. We have these issues abounding still today. Some Christian consciences, as I've said, forbid those believers to do certain things that are not wrong in themselves, but their consciences just can't quite get the message. There is a lag in their Christian understanding which renders their conscience vulnerable to false guilt. And when that is triggered, that false guilt, it tends to drive, as guilt always does, to drive a wedge between people and God and exposes them to Satan's deceptions. So Paul is trying to tell us here in verse 7 to the end of this chapter that some Christian rites are dispensable. He says on this matter of food, and he's talking about food that has been sacrificed to idols. They're at a social event. Something has been sacrificed to an idol and they're, what do I do now? He says food will not commend us to God. In and of itself, it doesn't make us worse if we do eat. It doesn't make us better if we do not. But here's what we've got to understand, verse 9. We've got to take a lot of care that this liberty of ours to eat or not to eat is not somehow becoming a stumbling block to the people, to the weak. Not weak people, but people with a weak conscience, as I have described. Their conscience has been trained or mistrained in a certain way. And we do not want to cause them to hit a tripwire of guilt by the way we exercise our Christian liberty. Paul says, I concede the point that strong brethren are making when they try to get weak brethren to get over it. That's what people still try to do. Somebody doesn't believe it's right to go to movies. Well, that may seem terribly silly to us, or some people think it's wrong to have a television in your home. And that may seem silly to us, though there's a lot of garbage that comes through that box. We don't have to watch that garbage, but that's what people get into. The scriptures say nothing about that. It has a lot of principles that may relate to that, but we can get into that kind of legalism where the rules, like some of the rules of Judaism, were man-made. They were human traditions. They are not God's revelation. It is true, he says, that food and drink in and of itself cannot defile a man. Jesus said that in Mark 14. It does nothing to commend a person to God, whether he partakes of it or doesn't partake of it. But for that very reason, Paul is saying you can afford to defer to the conscience scruples of the weak so as to protect them spiritually. No great principle is at stake that needs to be defended here. You have absolutely nothing to gain if you eat a piece of meat and nothing to lose if you abstain. Quite right. But they, the person with the weak conscience, they have something to lose if they transgress their conscience. And that is the problem that requires you and I to check our Christian liberties or our Christian rights at the door. And that's the reason we need to bring a little restraint to the table for the sake of love. Knowledge, theological knowledge about these issues, just puffs up and makes arrogance and eventually makes a fool out of us. But love pleases God, and love is interested in the spiritual welfare of my brother more than it is exercising my rights. So add a little Christian love to your knowledge, brethren, Paul is saying. So he talks in verses 9 through 12 about the awful danger and the reckless exercise of Christian liberty. If someone sees you who has knowledge, this theological knowledge, dining at an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened? I mean, he sees you and he says, well, if John can do it, old Joe here, we can do it. I mean, I like society. I like to be with people as much as he isn't, but I'm cut off. My conscience won't allow me to go in there and do that because it seems like I'm being disloyal to God. But I know John up there, and I know he loves the Lord, and, well, I'm going to give it a shot. And when he gives it a shot, he shoots his conscience. He's got a weak conscience. His conscience has been trained to believe that idol is real, and he feels like he is betraying his allegiance to God, and so he can't quite get his logic to work out the same way that John does, and he's spiritually wounded. He feels that he has sinned against God. And in fact, if we do that, if we act not in faith and confidence that we're doing the right thing, we do sin against God. When we take our conscience out there and our conscience is telling us, this is wrong, you shouldn't be doing this, and we do it anyway, then we're being reckless with God's interest. In fact, it may not have had anything to do with God's interest, but if we think it is and we do it anyway, then we know. Go back to that illustration of the wax woman I gave you. So if someone sees you have knowledge dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he who is weak, not a weak person, but a weak conscience as we've defined it, is ruined. The brother for whose sake Christ died. When he says ruined, he doesn't mean eternally destroyed, but he means ruined in this way, that what was pure and chaste is defiled. We've stained it with sin because the individual has trampled upon his conscience. His conscience was protesting, and he walked over top of it, and he violated it. And when there's sin, there is guilt, and when there is guilt, there is a reflex that drives us not to, not into the arms of the Lord, but drives us away from God in the sense that our fellowship with him is impaired. Guilt is a distemper of the soul, and by the loveless exercise of our liberty in that case, we have brought that about. And thus, by sinning against brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Ultimately, it's not just that brother, but ultimately our sin is against the Lord Christ himself. No Christian is at liberty to exercise his or her rights if we are likely to harm others whose scruples restrain them. Don't ever try to induce people to walk over top of their conscience. You may think that their conscience scruples are silly. And you know what? You may be right. They may be silly. But see, they don't yet have the understanding to see that. And if some way or other, through ridicule, or through rationalization, or through your own participation, they respecting you, you somehow impel them, tempt them, solicit them to trample on their conscience. You have caused them to sin. And when they sin, you have caused guilt and you have driven a wedge to some degree between them and the Lord. And in that way, you sin against Christ. The harm we do to others, we do to Christ. Besides, he implies, how could we refuse such small sacrifices? I mean, such as laying down our rights. How could we refuse that for the spiritual well-being of others when Christ sacrificed his life for them? Look, you don't have to eat that food. If you eat it, it's not going to do you any good. If you don't eat it, it's not going to make you any better, do you see? Notice he's not saying that we should always acquiesce to the will of others. That's not what he's saying here. Paul himself did not do that. He would not order Gentiles to be circumcised, for example. He would not insist that they observe the rituals of the Old Testament law. Principle was at stake. Mission was at stake. But where we have no important spiritual, moral, or mission stake in an issue, the apostle says, defer to any who might have something to lose if they're tempted to do things our way and to exercise liberties that our conscience has, but theirs doesn't. So in verse 13, he gives us a charitable attitude in the restraint of Christian liberty. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, that I might not cause my brother to stumble. If there's anything that I do which is morally indifferent or spiritually neutral, which may tempt or entice another believer to violate his unpermitting or forbidding conscience, then I am guilty of aiding and abetting his sin and refusing to honor the stoplight in his heart. It does not matter, folks, that I as a Christian have the right or the liberty before God to do or to refrain from doing this or that or whatever. I know it's no problem before God if I wear Argyle socks, if I wanted to wear Argyle socks. Doesn't matter a hill of beans. Doesn't matter whether I wear a tie or don't wear a tie. I know that's a non-issue with God. I'm using things ridiculous, but maybe not ridiculous to somebody. Wherever the exercise of my rights, and distinguish that from my duties, whenever the exercise of my rights tempts or entices another believer with a weak conscience to override that weak and easily offended conscience, then there is complicity in their sin on my part. I become as guilty before God for undermining their respect for the voice of their misinformed conscience as they are for disregarding it. Now, please understand this, however. This principle does not apply to the willful brother who is in no way tempted to ignore his conscience, however wrong his conscience may be, but is determined, the willful brother is determined to impose his beliefs on me as the will and law of God. I should never concede that or defer to that brother, for principle is at stake. If I decided, as once in a while, rarely, I do, that I want to come to church, I'm the pastor, and I want to stand up and wear jeans and just a shirt. If somebody thinks that that is wrong, well, that's okay if they think it is wrong. But they're not about to do that. They're a willful brother. That's not a weak conscience. And they're not about to do what I do. So I will, for principle's sake, for the sake of grace and Christian liberty, I will not allow them to intimidate me on that point. I will do, for principle's sake, what I need to do to show that that is not an issue that stands between a man and God. Well, my dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. Join us again the next time we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.